Amy Coney Barrett has just been confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court, replacing Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And now the balance has tipped on the Supreme Court, conservative versus liberal. And it seems like there's an idea that, that has caught fire, and that we're hearing that the Democrats may want to pack the court, meaning change the number of justices to sort of even out that conservative-liberal balance. Should the number be changed? And can it be changed? And how would that work? And is that a good idea? And with us to discuss this is Professor Carolyn Shapiro. She is the professor of law and associate dean for administrative and strategic initiatives at Chicago Kent College of Law here in Chicago. And she's the founder of the school's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. She has undergraduate master's in law degree from University of Chicago. She served as Illinois Solicitor General, arguing cases before the appellate courts and namely the U.S. Supreme Court. She was also a law clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Hi, welcome to the show, Professor. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Thank you for joining. You're so qualified to talk about this, and I'm excited because this is an issue that is very much of interest to me. Now, there are 9 justices on the court. We know that. How is that number? Is that mandated by the Constitution or by anything, or is that a random number that we somehow arrived at?
It's not exactly random. It's by statute, and it's been that way since the late 19th century. But it has, at various different times in American history, the number has been different. It's been as low as 6. It's been as high as 10. So it is not something that the Constitution requires.
And I think people were talking about how FDR tried to increase the number to try to get some of his programs that he was passing to be affirmed by the Supreme Court. How did that whole thing go? Was that something that almost happened, or was it resoundingly no?
It was pretty resoundingly rejected. He was trying, the Supreme Court was striking down legislation, New Deal legislation, that was making it very hard for the president to get his economic program during the Depression in place. He won rather resoundingly in 1936. He saw that as a mandate, and at that point floated the idea of adding justices to the court. But that idea didn't get much traction at all. But the other thing that happened at almost exactly the same time is that one of the justices on the court changed his approach, and the court went from striking down legislation on a 5-4 vote to upholding it. So that's known as the switch in time that saved 9, because it meant that to the extent that President Roosevelt would have pushed the idea, it became not so relevant.
So, Professor Shapiro, I've heard people talk, if Biden's elected, he's going to magically wave his little Biden wand and we'll have more justices. He can't do that, can he? Or would it have to be something from the Congress?
He cannot do that by himself. Congress would have to pass a law to change the number of justices on the court.
So let's just say that you want to give me the arguments for and against changing the number of justices. Why don't you just give me those arguments as best you can?
Well, the arguments against, I think, are pretty easy to imagine, including that once one party starts adding justices to the court, are we in a kind of tit-for-tat arms race? Also, we've had 9 justices for, a very long time, well over 100 years, and that there's something to be said for that level of stability. The arguments on the other side, though, have to do with the role of the court and the fact that the court, although it is supposed to be and is a counter-majoritarian institution, it also has come to be, because of the lack of term limits and because of the happenstance of when judges and justices have died or retired, and because of, and also in part because of the Mitch McConnell's refusal to consider Merrick Garland during President Obama's term in office. As a result, the court is extremely unbalanced in terms of the numbers of justices appointed by the presidents who have served over the last 20 years. Instead of being approximately even, which would be approximately what we would see if it were more systematic, we have a court that is now 6-3 Republican appointees. And that's problematic if the court is utterly out of step with the way the majority of Americans understand the basic principles of the Constitution.
Well, let's just say, playing devil's advocate to that argument. So it's 6-3 with the conservatives having the tipping the balance over there. But there probably have been times in history when the liberals have tipped the balance the other way. So would the argument then be that this is just a period in time that we're going to have to, it is what it is. And that will vary over time, but over hundreds of years, it will balance itself out at some point. Does that make sense as an argument? And what would be your response?
It certainly makes some sense as an argument. I don't know that it's really borne out. The court generally has not been a particularly liberal force. The period of time that people think of as being the court being sort of a force for progressive or liberal causes started with Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, went through the 60s and maybe somewhat into the 70s as the court recognized the need to advance racial justice, women's rights. That's during the time period during which the court decided Roe versus Wade. But that, even during that time frame, it was not a deeply unbalanced court in terms of which party had, which the presidents of different parties nominating different judges. I mean, no justice is going to always vote as any president imagines they will, or for that matter, as any person would imagine that they will. There is always going to be some unpredictability, which is as it should be, because the justices do, I think all of them, approach the cases with a certain level of open-mindedness, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have, at bottom, more representative overall consistency with the way the American people in general understand the Constitution.
I've said this a lot on my show, and I think Professor Shapiro, you'll agree with me that, just because somebody is against abortion from a moral standpoint or a religious standpoint doesn't mean that that justice will necessarily always rule against abortion in any case, because there are other things that need to be considered, such as case precedent, which means other cases that have been decided in the past, and the facts of the case, and again, if the judges all did what they wanted to do, they picked a plaintiff because they liked the plaintiff and they're always going to rule, then we'd have a hodgepodge of cases. Do you think it's pretty fair to say that the judges really do try to approach each case with a blank slate?
Well, I don't know if I would call it a blank slate. I mean, the justices come into their jobs with, decades of experience of having thought about the law. They all have judicial philosophies. They all have approaches that they take. And if they didn't, they'd be unqualified for the job. I mean, somebody who hadn't given these questions serious thought wouldn't be a reasonable pick to be a Supreme Court justice. So I wouldn't say blank slate. They often go in knowing what they think. Sometimes they've even written about it, and even if the opinion that they wrote about it in was not a majority opinion. But I think they go in they're not changing the strike zone for different parties, I guess I'll put it that way. But they have their points of view, they have their judicial philosophies, and so they are applying those judicial philosophies as they think is appropriate, as they think is what the Constitution requires. But there is no single right answer to the hard questions that come to the Supreme Court. That's why they're at the Supreme Court.
Because there's
a lot of room for discretion.
Right. A lot of people have disagreed about those issues. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Although I use the strike zone analogy, it's a terrible analogy. It's not balls and strikes. It's not deductive logic. It's applying principles about what the Constitution stands for, about the appropriate way of interpreting the Constitution, applying the Constitution, thinking about precedent to new and difficult situations. So it's not balls and strikes.
We're here with Professor Carolyn Shapiro from Chicago-Kent College of Law, and we're talking about court packing in this U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll be back in a minute on the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Thank you.
We're here with Professor Carolyn Shapiro from Chicago Kent College of Law, and we're talking a little bit about the Supreme Court, and this may be a little duplicative of what we were talking about before, but, you know, Judge Posner, who is an appellate, federal appellate judge in Chicago, who's written a lot of stuff and has a lot of opinions about things, he said that justices aren't chosen because they are necessarily smarter or better lawyers or the bigger legal stars. They simply reflect with the president what a president thinks would be in their best interests. And do you agree with that statement, Professor Shapiro? And if so, is that a legitimate way to choose justices?
Well, it's not legitimate to choose a justice because you think the justice might, for example, vote in favor of you in a contested election that's about to happen. So that, I would say that's not legitimate. But it is legitimate to choose a justice who you think reflects the judicial philosophy and constitutional commitments that you have and that the people who voted for you share. That I think is legitimate.
Do you think we're seeing, you know, obviously the polarization in politics is unbelievable. I mean, I think a lot of the tension that we are feeling has to do with COVID, but it has a lot to do with some of the political tension that we're feeling, at least I am. And with that kind of polarization, are we seeing this? Is that skewing the way that justices are recently being chosen?
I think what happened with Merrick Garland was certainly a particularly polarizing moment. Justice Scalia died in February of 2016. President Obama nominated Merrick Garland, who had been identified by Republican senators, including, for example, Orrin Hatch, as a moderate nominee who Senator Hatch thought could get through the Senate easily. Also, Merrick Garland was not particularly young, so it was very much of a centrist nomination. And Mitch McConnell, majority leader of the Senate, refused to even hold a hearing or bring that nomination to the floor. You combine that with the selection of a justice really within a few days or a week of Justice Ginsburg's death, and a confirmation that went through about 8 days before an election, that by itself, those two bookends of the Trump years in selecting justices is going to very much is a new, I would say that's new. It's not new for justices or nominees to be challenged based on their philosophy or their ideology. That's actually, there's a long history of that happening. So that part isn't new, but only allowing one Republican presidents nominate and Democratic presidents not to, which is what Mitch McConnell did, is new.
Now, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, who is also a presidential candidate, has talked about a plan that is kind of intriguing. And his plan was, or it was a proposal or maybe a thought, that it would expand the number of justices to 15. I think I'm going to say this right. With 5, we're going to be affiliated with Democrats, 5 affiliated with Republicans. And then there would be 5, quote, apolitical justices who were chosen by the first 10. Does that make any sense to you? Does that ring that would legitimize the process at all?
I think it's an interesting idea. And I think the law professors who actually originally came up with that idea, they were trying very hard to think of ways to depoliticize the court and to come up with a proposals that would be acceptable to people on both sides of the aisle. And so I think it's a very creative proposal in that way. It's a little unwieldy in a variety of ways, but it doesn't strike me as inherently a terrible idea, because it would make the court more of a court. It would make the court likely to be issuing narrower rulings, which is what I mean by that, sort of more legalistic rulings. And it would probably very much depoliticize it. Not completely. It can never be completely depoliticized. It's a political entity. But I think that particular proposal is unwieldy enough that it's not overwhelmingly likely to be adopted. But the impulse behind it I think is really valuable and something that's worth thinking very hard about.
What about term limits? Do you think that, like, I know in our state courts and people are getting ready to vote for judges, and a lot of people don't know who the heck they are, but there's places to go, and I'll give out that information later in the show to learn a little bit about the judges, and because they've been evaluated by some bar associations. But that said, mm-hmm. The federal judges are appointed for life, and that goes as it goes. And U.S. Supreme Court justices also are appointed for life. What would be the benefit, or would there be a benefit to having term limits?
Well, there would be some pretty significant benefits to having term limits. And the most popular proposal would have justices appointed for 18-year non-renewable terms. And they would be appointed in a staggered manner at one every 2 years. And what that would mean is that every president would get 2 appointments per term. You wouldn't have the situation that, say, Jimmy Carter had or George W. Bush had in his first term of not having any appointments. You also wouldn't have the situation where a justice, the happenstance of when a justice dies, as we saw with both Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg, dictates who ends up, or partially dictates in the case of Justice Scalia, who ends up the party of the president who appoints them. There are sort of their plans for how you would fill in a gap if somebody did die before their term was up. So you'd have something that much better reflected the country as a whole over a long period of time in terms of which presidents were in office at which times. Originally, sure. You know, people didn't live as long as they live now.
That's true.
So
right.
Life tenure in 1789 meant something. The expectations were probably very different.
Yes, you're right. Let's just kind of go a little general here. You clerked for a U.S. Supreme Court Justice, Justice Breyer, and that's for lawyers who understand that. I mean, you're at the top of the top. You're at the top of your law school, and it's a top law school, so you get to do this, and what a great experience it is.
It was.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really an amazing experience. Tell me what, just knowing what you know about the court and being there for arguments and being writing some of the opinions, or at least the first draft of it, what makes a good justice? Give me some qualities that you would say stand out as this is what we should be looking for in our U.S. Supreme Court justices.
Well, you certainly want somebody who is open to argument, who is interested in hearing from people who disagree with him or her. You want somebody who is going to actually be, I think, relatively collegial and able to work with people who they disagree with, because they are appointed, even if it was 18-year terms. It's a long time to work with other people. And it's important that they be able to maintain good working relationships, even if they vehemently disagree with each other. Obviously, you need somebody with incredible intelligence and legal acumen. But there are ways in which what we don't, and we have all of that, but what we don't have is people from a wide diversity of backgrounds, which would be good to have more diversity of backgrounds on the court. It would be good to have, but it would also be good to have it clearer when presidents nominate justices, and the Senate is considering them, that we're not just talking about an individual person and, you know, is this person smart enough or good enough? We're also talking about judicial philosophy and a belief in what the Constitution is about. So our more recent nominees by President Trump have espoused originalism, which means they believe the Constitution should be understood as they believe it was understood in 1789, or at the time of various amendments. Other justices, say Justice Breyer, who I clerked for, would say and has written that he thinks the point of the Constitution is to create a responsive democracy, and that the court's job is to the extent that there are difficult questions, that's part of the court's job, is to make sure that it is promoting democracy and promoting a responsive government. There are principles of liberty and equality in the Constitution, which different justices are going to apply in different ways and understand as being paramount in different ways. And that's something that we don't get a lot of during the confirmation hearings.
We don't have really much time at all, but I have a 20 seconds here. Would you like to be a Supreme Court justice? If you had your druthers.
The chances of that happening are extremely small, but sure.
Well, you know what? Never say never, as I always say. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for weighing in with all your intelligence and experience. Professor Carolyn Shapiro with Kent College of Law, thank you for joining us.